Okay, thank you. And there you can see my collaborators on the basis that, of course, Kareem was the postdoc working with two senior people, you know, who did the heavy lifting. Okay. Now, I want to begin with the comment that it's very common in many, many astronomical circumstances to have an accretion disk whose orbital axis bears no relation to the direction of the angular momentum of the gravitating object at the center. You can see quite a wide range of circumstances, from protostars to binary black holes, many, many places this sort of effect can happen. When it does, generically, the tilt is associated with a torque. Oddly, in astrophysical circumstances and in the astrophysical community, the general relativistic Lenz-Turing torque is better known than the purely Newtonian quadrupolar torque. But you know, that's how it is. And you can see up there the expression for the torque in the relativistic case, just lowest order post-Newtonian approximation. And notice that it has a rather specific character. The torque is purely precessional, and the precession frequency induced by that torque drops rapidly with radius, as r to the minus 3. I've also written there the Newtonian expression for the torque created by a binary. What's really going on here is it's the time average quadrupole of the binary. You don't actually need rotation to make the quadrupole, but a binary does make a quadrupole, and so you can tweak the expression into a form that mimics that of Lenz-Turing, and once again, it's a purely precessional torque in which J here is the angular momentum of the central object, L is the orbital angular momentum of the orbiting material. Now, a question that comes up quite naturally, given the rapid increase toward the center in this precession frequency, is what happens in the center of the disk where that precession frequency might even be perhaps competitive with the orbital frequency, or approaching that. And for almost 40 years now, in the case of Lenz-Turing torque, the general picture in everyone's minds, introduced first by Koos Pedersen and Jim Bardeen, is that some sort of friction in the inner rings makes those rings come into alignment with the spin of the black hole at the center. But because the precession frequency drops so rapidly outward, at large radius where the disk is fed with that oblique angular momentum, it has the direction that it's been given, and then just somewhere in between goes into the plane of the black hole in the center. And there's a very large literature analyzing how this might happen quantitatively. That's many of the papers. I don't think I could fit all of the papers onto the slide. And it seems to me that in some respects, the focus of the discussion is a little bit misplaced. It's generally posed in terms of some sort of frictional dissipation bringing the rings into alignment. But if you're going to rotate the direction of an angular momentum from oblique to vertical, you need to torque it. You need to add a vector angular momentum that brings it into line. Dissipation may very well be associated with that torque, but it's really the torque that's doing the job of alignment. There's also a second question raised by this picture, which is that if the torque is purely precessional, that means it's exactly perpendicular to the local angular momentum, local orbital angular momentum, and that means it has zero effect on alignment. It makes it, you know, the plane rotate around, but it doesn't make the plane, it doesn't make the axis of the angular momentum settle into the axis of the central object. So to understand how alignment might actually take place, clearly what we're going to need to do is to understand how angular momentum is transported radially within a disk when it's oblique or possibly warped. The basic picture was, I think, first said clearly 30 years ago, this work by Jim Pringle and John Papaloizou. They pointed out that if you have a warped disk, then you can imagine starting out with a flat disk with the usual hydrostatic equilibrium perpendicular to the plane, pressure supported, and just displacing elements, one with respect to the other. If you do that, that's how you create the warp, then that immediately creates radial pressure gradients because those hydrostatic contours are no longer aligned with one another. Is there a laser pointer here? Ah, here. There we go. Okay, so you can see it there. This little segment has been pushed up, this one down, and the pressure is higher here, and higher there than there. So if you have radial pressure gradients, they will drive radial motions. The radial motion, the fluid carries its angular momentum with it in a radial direction, and that leads to radial transport and perhaps mixing of angular momentum. To characterize this, there's a useful figure, in fact, first introduced by Nelson and Papaloizou about a dozen years ago, which is the ratio of how large the warp is. This is the logarithmic radial derivative of the unit vector in the direction of orbital angular momentum. And it takes that in ratio to the disk's aspect ratio, its vertical scale height divided by r. When this number, which Kareem and I like to call psi hat, is greater than 1, there are order unity pressure differences across a factor of 2 in radius. And so that leads to essentially nonlinear hydrodynamics in the radial flow. So certain obvious questions arise here. Number one, given that there will be radial motions, how fast are they? Where do they go? How far do they get? A second one is, if somehow this radial transport of angular momentum does manage to flatten and align the inner disk, where is the divide between that region and the outer region that's misaligned? And then finally, given that you need to inject torque of the right direction, magnitude at the right place to align that misaligned disk, how exactly is it delivered? Where does it come from? There's a traditional approach to this based on the famous Shakura Sinyaev alpha prescription. And I want to briefly review this to explain the distinction between the way alpha is used in the warp disk context and the way it's used in conventional accretion disks. In its original formulation, in the Shakura Sinyaev form, it applies to flat disks. They were not thinking about warp disks at all. And in that case, of course, they started out with the correct assertion that molecular viscosity fails miserably to account for angular momentum transport in accretion disks. Just basically, to the degree that the stuff behaves like a fluid, the actual viscosity is tiny. Those go directly together. And so they just thought about it in terms of dimensional analysis and said, aha, the only thing with dimensions of stress and of momentum flux is the local pressure. So let's suppose that this momentum flux required to carry the angular momentum is some dimensionless number alpha times that local pressure. This is purely dimensional analysis. There's no statement here about what sort of mechanism this might be. And in their discussion, they actually strongly disfavor viscosity. Now, this is a wonderful tool. Let's see, I think the citation count in ADS is up around 5,000 now. I mean, it's been extremely widely used. And extremely widely misused. In particular, it's despite the clear statement against this in the original paper, a great part of the astrophysical world refers to it as an alpha viscosity, which it is not. And certainly that statement does not, that paper did not at all suggest it's a viscosity. Now the second part has to do with how it's used in the warp context. And just about all the previous literature follows this assumption. Just about the only exception I'm aware of is the work by Chris Frigill and collaborators, and you'll hear more from him later in the day. So I hope you can, as many of you as possible, can stick around to the final talk of the afternoon and hear from him. So what all these other people do is they, first of all, imagine that the Shakura-Sinyaev dimensional analysis stress really is a viscosity. And second, that it's isotropic in the sense that this coefficient alpha that describes its magnitude is independent of the direction in which you're transporting momentum. Stress, after all, is a tensor quantity. You have two vectors involved, and you know, many different Newtonian, there are 9 different components, not all of them independent. And they suppose that the alpha applies equally well to shears and stresses in all directions. Now, if this is what actually happened in disks, then it would act in particular on the shear flow of these radial motions. They tend to increase away from the midplane, so there is an RZ shear. And to the extent that this alpha viscosity is large, it diminishes that shear, which reduces the radial motions, which makes the mixing slower. And so what they came to call alpha 2 is inversely proportional to the ordinary alpha. Okay. But we've known for 20 years, roughly half the time since Shakur and Sinyaev, that the real stresses inside disks are not viscous at all. They're Maxwell primarily. And they come out of the nonlinear growth of the magnetorotational instability pointed out by Steve Balbus and John Hawley that drives nonlinear MHD turbulence. And so the question is, how or does that actually change the picture? To answer that question, you need to actually get your hands dirty and sort of go under the, lift the hood of this engine, see what happens. And unfortunately, numerical simulations are the only good tool we have. So it's a lot of work. It's hard to see the end from the beginning. It doesn't have the wonderful clarity of analytic work, but at least you know what the physics that you've put in. It's not easy to do because this is an intrinsically three-dimensional problem. There are no symmetries here. You can't do wedges. You can't make various other approximations in terms of geometry. And you need a lot of cells to properly describe the MHD turbulence, so it's computationally expensive. The simulation that we did ended up consuming 1.3 million processor hours. So it's big. Now, given that, you have to make choices of strategy about which approximations you'll make and which you'll try to do well. And we decided that what we really wanted to do was to describe the MHD effects well in a moderately thin disk and to make this a kind of physics problem in which we want to be able to follow the precession effects, but not necessarily in a strictly realistic way. And what I mean here is that, kind of in the spirit of particle and cell codes, where in order to reconcile the disparate timescales of electrons and ions, they set ME over MP to, let's say, 20 or 30, rather than MP over ME to 20 or 30 instead of the correct 1800. We decided to work in basically a Newtonian framework with just the lowest order post-Newtonian version of the torque and arbitrarily make the precessional frequency about a tenth of the orbital frequency. Because to compute the MHD, you need to follow the orbital timescale. If the precessional frequency is very, very slow compared to that, you'd compute forever before anything happened. So we decided we'll make it smaller than the orbital frequency, but not as enormously smaller as it might realistically be. And then it became a tractable calculation. To get this going, what we actually did was to set up a flat disk in the equatorial plane of the coordinate system. We let the MHD go to saturation. That took some 15 orbits at roughly the mass midpoint of the disk. And only when the MHD turbulence was established did we turn on the torques. And these torques came from a spin that was misaligned from the axis of the disk by 12 degrees. And as said, the ratio of orbital frequency at mid-disk to the precessional frequency was 15. And then we ran at 15 mid-disk orbits, one mid-disk precessional period, to see what happened. In addition, we set up a matched pure hydrodynamic simulation so we could tell the difference between what MHD did and what would happen without it. Okay, so here is an animation. You can see the initially flat disk building the MHD turbulence and expanding because, of course, there is angular momentum transport due to the MHD turbulence within that spout. The time up here is now sort of 6-7 orbits into the torques. And you can see the plane of rotation changing from the inside out. There's the finish. So I think you can see from that animation, the disk started like this, and then from the working from the inside out, by the end of the simulation, it was like that. So it really did move into alignment with the central spin direction. I'd attach a sizable error bar. You know, the one thing I'm confident of is that the